the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war!
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles... This special episode of Veterans Chronicles features two men whose careers in show business were largely shaped by their experience in the military. Pat Sajak, famed host of Wheel of Fortune, and Kenny Thomas, country music star and former Army Ranger. Pat Sajak joined the Army in 1968, eventually finding his way to Vietnam, where he became a popular disc jockey for Armed Forces Radio Service, hosting a number of programs, including the famous Good Morning Vietnam. In this first segment of Veterans Chronicles, American Veterans Center President James C. Roberts speaks to Pat about his service and his broadcasting career since.
Well, let's begin by talking about your early years growing up in Chicago. Your introduction to the broadcast media, as I recall, was actually through radio, right? How did that come about?
It was. You know, actually, the first time I was ever on radio in Chicago was a big deal because the big rock and roll station, as anyone from Chicago would know, was WLS in Chicago. And
right.
There was a guy named Dick Biondi who was the big, you know, sort of teen idol disc jockey there. In fact, I think Dick may be still on the air. He's about 112, but still looks great and still on the air in Chicago. Anyway, I was in high school, and they had a guest teen disc jockey contest, and you would literally send a postcard. Yes, boys and girls, they used to be postcards. And you would just, you know, write your name, and they'd draw it out. And the first week, they had some kid on there. And when you won, you got to go on and host an hour with Dick. And when the first week, whoever was there was on, and they drew out the winner for the following week, and it was me. So my first job in radio, my first time on radio, was at a big radio station in Chicago. But it was a few years before I ever worked again. I wasn't all that good, but I worked, at little stations, and you know, the nature of radio is such you sort of move along. And I worked in suburban Chicago, and I worked in Murray, Kentucky, and I worked in Nashville, and I bounced around a bit, and in Saigon.
Yeah, and we'll get to that here in just a minute. But you had a work experience with a Spanish language radio station in Chicago, which I found quite amazing. Tell us about that.
You know, one of the hardest questions you get is when younger people come up to you, and these days almost everyone is younger, and they come up and say, you know, how do I get started? What do I do? And it's hard to answer the question because it's a weird business. I mean, and if you want to be a doctor, I can tell you to go to medical school, and then you're an intern, and then you do this and you do that. Radio, who knows? Everyone, if you talk to 100 people who've had some success, there are 100 different stories. But my first real job, I was looking for work, and I knew a guy who was in broadcasting. He said, look, I know this station manager here at this, and he wrote down the call letters of a station I had never heard of in Chicago called WEDC. It was a little tiny 250-watt station. He said, just go in. And I go in, I meet the guy, and he has me read a couple of things. He said, you're starting tonight at midnight. I said, well, that's great. And he said, you're going to do the, my deal was I was hired to do the news every hour, sort of a rip and read newscast. You take the news right off the wire and you read it for 5 minutes, and that was it. So he said, there'll be a, you know, radio show on. And what he neglected to tell me was that it was a Spanish radio show. And I showed up that night, literally, and the guy speaking Spanish to me. Well, it turned out it was a foreign language radio station. I worked on a show from midnight to 6 a.m. The guy spoke Spanish. He played Spanish music, played Spanish commercials, and once an hour I did the news in English. To this day, I don't know how or why, but that was my... In fact, I didn't know... the only time I knew it was time for me to do the news, he'd go, I don't know the language. He was like, So, you know, it's hard to tell anyone that that's the way you should start.
That's a great story. In 1968, you enlisted in the Army. Pick up the Pat Sajak story there, if you would.
Yeah, I was going to college at the time and in Chicago, and, you know, I was going okay. I think it was my third year, and I'm not sure I was the most devoted student, but I just, the idea of sticking around for another year and getting the degree, and I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, and I thought, And I was, at that time, you know, the draft was going pretty heavily, and I suspected that once I graduated, I would probably end up in the Army anyway. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to get a jump on it. And I joined in 68, which was a three-year hitch at the time. And as you may recall, there was some little conflict going on in Southeast Asia. And they sent me there. They train. It's odd. The Army was a wonderful experience, but they have some odd aspects to them. For example, I joined and I had broadcasting experience, so I thought maybe I would have a chance to move into that area. And instead, they made me a clerk typist, and then they sent me to Saigon and made me a finance clerk, which I had no skill in, but yeah. I learned to do that.
Totally expected, really.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm at a place called Long Bin, a fort outside Saigon, and I was there for a few months, and I was doing pretty well with my financial stuff, keeping records for the guys who were, you know, doing the hard work over there. But I kept applying to get transferred to Saigon and get into Armed Forces Radio, or AFVN, over there. And I kept getting turned down. And eventually, it's funny how things come around. Eventually, I wrote a note to the guy who used to own that little foreign language radio station we just talked about. Mm-hmm. And he was a U.S. congressman, as it happened. I said, yeah, I'm trying to get this transfer. If you can... I can't get it out of this. The guy really wants me to stay here and stay as a finance clerk, and I just think I have more abilities beyond that that might be put to better use. And he, you know, dropped a note to someone, and it got me an interview in Saigon with the folks who were there, and they ended up hiring me or transferring me. And so I was able to make the move, and for about a year and a half, I was the morning disc jockey in Saigon, yelling "Good morning, Vietnam" at the top of my lungs every day at 6 a.m., which is not a smart thing to do when the enemy is hovering.
Yeah, you were the successor of Adrian Cronauer, right?
Yeah, not the immediate successor. I think Adrian, I'm not sure when he was there. I want to say more like 66, maybe even 65. Mm. But I was there in late 68 through 69, and I think there may have been a guy or two between us. I never met Adrian, but... So that was the when you took over that show, you kind of took over the format, and the format included the Good Morning Vietnam business.
Yeah, I've read that you were not a huge fan of military rules and regulations.
Well, it makes me sound rebellious, and I wasn't quite that. But you know, we were radio guys, and I, you know, we were in uniform, but. But part of the reason for that is that the Army, and I think they were wise to do it, encouraged us, and it was a joint service operation. I'm in the Army, but all the military branches were represented at the station. But they wanted us to sound like a stateside radio station. In other words, you know, these men and women were over there in a very tough spot away from home, and they wanted something that sounded like home. So we didn't use our rank on the air. We didn't... If you tuned in, it sounded like a stateside rock and roll radio station, which is what we tried to sound like. So it wasn't conducive to military discipline, I suppose. But we enjoyed that aspect. It was funny because we were a government-run station, if you will. We didn't run commercials. We weren't selling products. But again, because we wanted it to sound like a stateside station, we produced these what sounded like commercials, and they had the same production values of commercials, but it was things like keep your M16 clean and stuff like that. So it was an odd experience, but it was a great one. I laugh because it was a big market at the time. There were 500,000 American servicemen there, and all of the civilian Americans who were there, and most of the local population spoke English, and they wanted to hear that kind of music. That's what they listened to. So we actually had a pretty big audience.
Is it true you were supposed to give your rank as well as your name on the program, and you declined to do that?
Well, they, and again, it wasn't a matter of rebelliousness, and eventually they did away with that. My argument was, you know, if the idea is to make this sound stateside, why do we do that? Because it's just a reminder every time you mention your name that, you know, you're in the Army now. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but again, the purpose was to get people sort of away from that. And it took a while to convince them, and I guess it was a little rebellious because I didn't want to do the rank thing. So I ended up just not doing my name at all for about 6 months. It was this anonymous guy doing the show, but I just didn't want to keep reminding them that I'm sitting there in a uniform. I wanted to think they're listening to a station back home.
I'm just trying to imagine how that worked. I mean, 6 months without ever mentioning your name.
That's how I learned my humility.
What was the routine like for the program itself?
Well, it was it was what you'd expect, what radio was like in the late 60s, early 70s. A little different now. I mean, disc jockeys are a little less important. It's all about playing more music, and you'll often, you know, back then you announce what the record was, and we did that thing that disc jockeys did back then where we called it talking up to the vocal, you know, this little instrumental beginning to a song, and you keep talking about the time or the temperature or something until the guy started singing. And so it had that sound. It had that, you know, I grew up, as I said, in Chicago listening to WLS, and it had that kind of a sound to it. But it was the music that was popular in the day. You know, it was the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and whatever else was going on. There were two kinds of music at the time. There was sort of this harder edge stuff, and some of it was a reaction to the war, I think, and the turmoil that was going on in the country. And then on the softer side, there was sort of this bubblegum music, the Archies and Sugar and stuff like that, mm-hmm. that you're almost embarrassed by. But it was odd. There were two tracks of music, but we played all of it. And we were a little, because we were on in the morning, we didn't play the harder stuff that was more in the evening. But again, it was whatever was popular among what was essentially young men who were listening to this show.
Any reflections you have of note of your time in Vietnam, of the war itself, the way it was conducted?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because sometimes you're so close to something. You know, people ask me that, and you know, for opinions, and they're hard to give because you're caught up in your day-to-day life, and it's hard. In a way, it's harder to get kind of a macro view when you're there doing your daily stuff. That's what you're concentrating on. I don't want to say guilt, that's probably too strong a word, but I was sensitive to the fact that I was very lucky. I mean, I was sent to Vietnam, which is, there are better places to be sent.
Right,
I
right,
suppose.
Indeed.
And I had a pretty soft job. You know, I was in playing records, for goodness sakes, and living out of a hotel and that was converted to be military use. So it was, as I say, pretty soft work. And, you know, guys would come in out the field for an R&R or whatever into the city, and you'd see them, and you know, we almost felt embarrassed that you had this kind of soft life. But I had a lot of guys come up to me then, and to this day I still do. Guys who say, you know, I remember listening, and it was a slice of home, and I really appreciate it. So I convinced myself at some level we were doing some good.
When Veterans Chronicles returns, Pat Sajak picks up his story with his return to civilian life after military service.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. After returning home from Vietnam, Pat Sajak continued on in a career in broadcasting. In this segment, Pat recalls the road that led to his becoming the host of Wheel of Fortune.
In, I guess, 1970, you returned to civilian life. What happened then?
Well, I did. I actually, when I extended for an extra 6 months in Vietnam, so I was there about a year and a half, and then I finished up my military tour in D.C., actually. I was working at the Pentagon in a non-broadcast position. This is odd. It's funny. I hadn't thought about this in a long time, but I was running the audio-video equipment down in sort of the war planning room in the sub-basement of the Pentagon. In other words, if there had been an atomic war, for example, and all the big guys would go down there and run the war from there, and they would need video and slides and whatever needed to be done to update them, and I would be running that equipment, so we'd have test runs. But it was happily never used for that purpose while I was there. The only time it was actually active down there was, oddly enough, during a postal strike when the military was called on to deliver some mail. We had to do some updates there. So I'd rather use that for a postal strike than an atomic war. So, but I finished up there. I worked there for a little less than a year, and I stayed in Washington trying to get some jobs in broadcasting, and virtually every radio and television station in Washington has my resume, but none of them was smart enough to hire me. Can you believe that? So I was sort of starting fresh again, and I had a friend who knew a guy who owned a tiny radio station, again, 250 watts. That was apparently as powerful as I could get those days, in a little town called Murray, Kentucky, tucked away in the southwestern corner of that state. And I went down there, and I was working for minimum wage. I was probably 25 years old at the time and doing a radio show from 7 to midnight. And I remember one day sitting there and I playing these songs, and I thought, you know, my career is not exactly booming. And I packed up what little I had, stuck it into my old car, and drove to the nearest big town, which happened to be Nashville, Tennessee. And after some time of working at a Howard Johnson's and just trying to make ends meet, I caught on at a television station there. And that was sort of the beginning of my career for me. I was hired as an announcer. Eventually, they let me do weather and news and talk shows. And my next stop after Nashville was L.A. in local television. So it was a circuitous route.
What was your plan or your hope, at least, when you moved to L.A.?
You know, they hired me in L.A. to be the weatherman at the local NBC station out there, and I didn't have a specific broadcasting goal. I always wanted to be in radio or television, and I thought if I were the morning guy in Cleveland, I'd be pretty happy. But you never know what route it's going to take. But the nice thing about working in Los Angeles, and I was doing the weather, as I said, and a local talk show on the weekends, and the nice thing about working out there is, in a way, you're auditioning every day because the producers who do television shows are out there watching the news like everybody else. And one of those guys was Merv Griffin, who had created a show called Wheel of Fortune, had been on the air for about 6 years with a guy named Chuck Woolery, and Chuck was leaving, and he needed a substitute host, and he liked my work from the local stuff and called me and asked me to do the show, and here we are 30 years later. So it's a funny career.
30 years.
People always ask, well, do you have any idea? And the answer, of course, is of course not. I mean, who did? And that's 30 years with me there. It was on six years in daytime.
Before that. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a funny thing. When I took the show, my vision was, this is my first national show, and it was just a daytime show on NBC. It was not, we didn't have the nighttime version. And it, as I say, had been on at that time for about 7 years, and I thought, and it was appeared to be fading. It's kind of had its run, and so my vision was that I would take over the show. It has another year, maybe two, in it. It would go away, and then I would have established a little national credibility and could move on to something else. But it kind of got a second wind and started winning its time period during the day. And then a couple years later, they started the nighttime version, which we all know now, and went through the roof immediately and was a huge hit, and it's been the number one show in syndication ever since it went on the air back in 1983. So, you know, here we are going on 30 years and still spinning that darn thing.
Yeah, quite remarkable, as I say. You've had much other TV experience as well, which we don't really have time to get into, but one thing I wanted to ask you about being a baseball fan is about baseball, because you're a huge baseball fan. Tell us about some of your baseball-related activities.
Well, I am. For several years, I hosted a radio show on MLB radio, Major League Baseball radio, and it was fun because I got to pretend I was a jock every now and then and interview players and managers and all that stuff. But I also own a piece of something called the Golden Baseball League, which is headquartered out west in California. And in fact, we've got a team in Maui, and we've got a couple of teams up in Canada. It's called the Golden Baseball League. It's an independent sort of Class A league, and rather than own a team, the owners own the league, and the league owns the teams, and that allows for a certain consistency.
How many teams?
It varies from year to year as minor league. Right. Minor leagues tend to do, but it's about 10 teams now. But it's finished. It's been around for 6 years, so it's got a pretty good run, and it's been a fun experience.
Great. Well, we're looking forward to seeing you on Memorial Day, Pat. What does Memorial Day mean to you?
Well, it's, you know, when as anyone who has served their country, it, it, it tends to take a deeper meaning than it did when you were a kid, and it was a time to, you know, to make hamburgers, and we still do that, and we still have fun with it. But you do have you do have a real sense of what it means, and you do have a real sense and appreciation of everyone who's gone before you and the sacrifices they made and the fact that you're able to do those hamburgers, you know, and relax.
Thank you very much for being my guest today on Veterans Chronicles.
Thanks, Jim.
Coming up on Veterans Chronicles, former Army Ranger and country music star Kenny Thomas talks about his service. Stay tuned.
Hello, I'm Jim Billington, the Librarian of Congress. There are more than 17 million wartime veterans living in the United States today. Each of these brave men and women took an oath to serve this great nation during times when many had to make the ultimate sacrifice. Now they have an opportunity to tell the world about their personal experience through the Library of Congress Veterans History Project. This congressionally mandated program collects, preserves, and makes accessible the wartime stories of those Americans who served during the two world wars in Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Won't you yourself collect and preserve the story of at least one veteran? Help us gather in the accounts of 10,000 veterans by Veterans Day. Pledge to preserve this important part of America's history.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. The Battle of Mogadishu, portrayed in the book and movie Black Hawk Down, was one of the most intense fights U.S. Special Operations Forces has ever engaged in. Among the combatants was former Army Staff Sergeant Kenny Thomas, a member of the elite Army Rangers. Following his service, Thomas has gone on to a successful career in the recording industry as a country music artist and continues to tour the world performing for our troops in USO shows. This segment, guest host Dr. Lewis Sorley sits down with Kenny Thomas to talk about his experience on the battlefield and his career since.
What outfit were you with when you were in Somalia?
When I was with the Ranger Regiment, the Task Force Ranger that most people know about the story with the book from the book Black Hawk Down had quite a different many special operations units, but I was with the Ranger Regiment.
And let's back up. How did you get to there? Where are you from?
How did I get to the Army?
Yeah.
That's all my recruiter. That was not my fault.
Where are you from?
I grew up in Gainesville, Florida.
Yes.
And graduated from there and joined the Army in 91 when the first Gulf War started, thinking I needed to get in and do my part. And I think I wasn't even through with basic training and the Gulf War was over. I was like, uh-oh, I might have made a big mistake.
They went too fast for you.
Yeah, they did.
Were there any military people in your family's background?
Absolutely. My dad was a Ranger.
Your dad was a Ranger?
Yeah. In fact, it's an interesting thing. When we go overseas and we do all our USO tours, and whenever I'm doing some sort of a military day musically, I'll ask everybody in the audience, I'll go, hey, everybody raise your hand back here who had a relative, grandma, grandfather, uncle, father that served in the military before you.
Yes.
I promise you, you probably know this, 90% of the people will raise their hand.
Yeah.
It's a family business.
Yeah.
It is a family business.
Yeah. So when you enlisted, where did they send you?
They sent me to Fort Benning.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up staying there. That's where the Ranger Regiment headquarters
now
was.
Now, you have to volunteer for the Rangers, isn't that right?
You do. You got to go. You volunteer a few times. You get through basic training, then through AIT, then through airborne school, and then through the Ranger indoctrination program. And then you spend the first 3 or 4 months at the Ranger Regiment just getting screamed at because they're trying to make you quit.
Yes.
Make sure you really want to be there.
Yes.
And then you get to go. You spend about 8 months to a year before they'll send you to Ranger school because they need to get you groomed up.
Okay.
To go to a leadership school like Ranger School is.
Yeah. Who was your Ranger buddy?
Oh, I've got lots of them, my friend. lots of them. That list goes on and on.
But going to Ranger School?
It depended on what phase we were in, for sure.
Uh-huh.
Ranger School was a blur. I was asleep, hallucinating at something. I do remember one, because everybody's got a hallucination story about Ranger School.
Lack of sleep deprivation.
Oh, yeah. When we were crossing a creek, and I remember looking at the guy in front of me, and I'm thinking, wow, that was cool. He brought a keyboard. I could play piano. And I'm reaching out to play the piano he had put on his back. And I'm like, man, how cool is that? And next thing I know, someone's whacking me in the back. And like, Thomas, what? They had already moved about 100 meters down the road. And I was standing there in the middle of the creek reaching out and playing piano. Yes.
Now, once you're qualified as a Ranger,
mm-hmm.
and you got the tab and you're one of them, where do you serve?
Well, you get to go to one. If you're in the Ranger Regiment, you're going to one of the three Ranger Battalions, 1st, 2nd, or 3rd. And one is in Savannah, one's in Fort Benning, Georgia, and one's over in Fort Lewis, Washington.
Okay.
And I ended up at 3rd Battalion, which is in Columbus, Georgia, Fort Benning.
All right.
So stayed there. And then when I got back from Somalia, I ended up going over to the reconnaissance team.
Wait a minute. Let's not skip over Somalia that fast.
Okay.
How'd you get to Somalia?
That's another one. It's not hard to do. It's very easy to get sent to combat. They send you where you got to go. There had been a.
Did you go with a unit or as an individual?
I went with BECO. My company was the only company sent. If you want to back up, and I'll tell you why we were there. There was a guy who was a warlord, Muhammad Adid, and Adid had been attacking the United Nations, the food shipments. When he started attacking American troops that were guarding the food shipments, then we were sent in to find this guy and bring him to justice. So it was a task force that was put together of several different special operations units within the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. And so we were one part of it.
And what would you describe your own job title as then?
Well, I was a team leader, a young guy in charge of, now in a squad, in the infantry, a squad usually has 8 to 10 men.
All right.
You have a squad leader and 2 team leaders. But the Rangers have always been a little bit shorthanded. We did not have a full squad. We had 5 guys.
All right.
So there was just, we didn't really warrant having another team leader, so it was just me and my 3 men. So,
all right.
And that's my little responsibility and my little world was those guys.
And tell us what happened.
Most people are pretty familiar with how the battle went down, but our part, there were so many working parts of that battle, and you are constantly, especially at events like this where you come to a town, there's a lot of veterans and they're all getting together, you run into some people who were part of the battle in a different place.
Okay.
But my squad was the left side of a helicopter called Super 66, and we were part of the assault package. So we were going into town to get some bad guys that were in a building. The idea being that the assault unit would go in first, get the bad guys that were in the building, and then there would be a reaction force that was off waiting in the city, and they would drive up with the trucks. We'd put the bad guys on the trucks, and everybody would exfil.
Okay.
And where the mission changed, we did, in a half hour, we had gotten the 12 bad guys that were in the building. The mission was a success, what we originally went in to do.
Did you capture them or kill them?
We caught them all. They were going to bring them in for questioning. And
okay.
We knew they were on our most wanted list, so we got all these guys. So we're all thinking, there were some people who had been shooting. It was a little bit of a hot LZ, but it wasn't anything too bad. And I still, even when I describe it, it makes me giggle that I say there are people shooting at us, and it wasn't that bad. But it wasn't that bad because they were missing. You know,
makes a huge difference.
Yeah,
yes,
that's what you want them to do. Yeah. But we're waiting to get exfilled, and we're already thinking, oh gosh, you know, we're all combat veterans. We just got fired at. We fired back a couple of times. I was already thinking about writing home, and I can qualify for a VA loan. This is going to be great. I'm a combat vet. Well, in the time that we were waiting to get exfilled is when the first helicopter got shot down. So the mission has now changed, and the bird went down about 5 to 6 blocks away from us. So the whole thing changed, and we were asked now to go secure this crash site and take care of if there was anyone still alive, make sure we could get them out of there, and if there was anyone that wasn't alive, make sure that we got them out of there.
Okay.
And the mission changed, and we stayed there. It was those 18 hours of that battle, getting to that crash site, securing a crash site, getting the bodies out, getting the wounded that we incurred during that battle and getting them out the next morning, which is what.
And what became of your captives while you're doing this?
The captives were exfilled earlier on.
You'd gotten rid of them.
They had already gone with the vehicles back to the base.
Now, is this the action for which you were decorated for valor?
Yes, sir. There was quite a few guys on that on that day.
Yes. When you got out of there, where did you go?
In the morning.
When that mission of securing the crash site and so on was over.
When we got to the crash site, what had happened was the pilot's body had been crushed into the wreckage, so it took quite a bit of time to get the man out.
Yes.
We kind of holed up. We had been in buildings and different pockets of fighting up and down the street, up and down kind of a 2-block radius all the night. The big reaction force, the QRF, which was made up of the rest of the Rangers, cooks, medics, everybody that could put a flak jacket on or body armor on and a rifle came, and the 10th Mountain came out. The 10th Mountain doesn't get mentioned too often when people talk about Black Hawk Down, but we were very grateful to see them in the morning. And then we loaded up all of our casualties and sent them off, and the rest of us kind of footed it out. People don't realize we had lost 4 helicopters in that. 2 crashed in the city, which we know about. The other 2 were crashed, and they were able to piloed them into a safe zone.
Crash landing.
Of the 150 men that went in on the ground, we had about 78 were wounded and 18 died. That was a big lot of, if you do the math, well over 70% of the people got hit that day.
Yes.
But I will tell you that had it not been for the level of our training, had it not been for the planning, but mainly for the leadership at every single level, had it not been for the guys on our left and our right, those numbers would have been significantly higher.
Yeah.
And I say leadership, I don't mean the colonels and the generals and even the captains. I mean Private David Floyd, who the only person he was leading was himself, but he was leading by example, and he was taking care of the guys to his left and his right, and that's what got us all out of there.
That's a great part of the story. The guys stepped up when the need came.
They have to. And you know, you're in a position where you've done so many interviews. The stories are always the same. It's always about the past. It doesn't matter whether it was our grandpa on the beaches of Normandy or World War II or uncles in Korea or my dad in Vietnam or my best friends in Afghanistan. Ultimately, when you ask them about their story, they're going to end up talking about the people that were around them. Because by the grace of God, that's the only reason you're here.
I couldn't have said it better.
Right.
Now I'd like to find out what happened to you after your Army service, because I think you've built a remarkable career as a musician and, if I may put it this way, as a public servant there as well.
Thank you. Well, that is the way that I kind of look at it. There was every morning at Zero Dark 30, the Rangers had a creed, and they stand up and they yell the creed. And the very first stanza said, "Recognizing I volunteered as a Ranger, fully knowing the hazards of my chosen profession. I volunteered knowing the hazards." And I don't know if everybody out there has a creed that they get up every morning and yell.
No, I wouldn't think so.
But it instills something in you, which is you're here to serve a purpose. When you're wearing a uniform, doing something that matters and being purposeful is an easy thing to do. All you do is wake up in the morning and do the right thing. When you get out in the real world and you're not wearing a uniform, how do I make a difference? And I tell folks, man, it's so easy if all you do is lead. And I don't mean be in charge. I just mean set an example. Lead by example. Set an example for others to follow, and everybody will take notice. So in everything you do. Now, there's a verse that's on the walls of the Ranger Regiment. And you may not have a creed, but if you need a creed to go by, I got one for you. It's on the walls of the Ranger Regiment. It's on the walls. Actually, it's on the walls of every special operations unit out there, and it's from the Bible. It's the book of Isaiah, chapter 6, verse 8. And Isaiah 6, 8 reads, "I heard the voice of the Lord saying, who will go for us and whom shall I send? And I answered, here am I. Send me."
Yes.
Send me. So, see, I used to think that was just a really cool military. Oh, yeah, Isaiah wrote a military verse, because it's easy for us to, in the military, say, send me, I'll go. Yes. But when you get out here in the world, what do? But you can still be sent, and you can still use everybody's got gifts. Everybody's got something unique to them. Everybody's got special that only you can contribute. And go out there and do it. And I was given a gift to tell a story with a melody and play a guitar and play the piano. And I will entertain folks. We will have fun songs. But at the end of the day, I have something to say.
How far back does that musical interest and performance go with you?
That's a disease you're born with. I don't think you can. I wouldn't know what else to do.
Who was your first teacher?
My first real influence was a choir teacher in church, and her whole thing was, let's get kids into the church that wouldn't be here, like me, through music.
Okay.
So she instead of doing like hymnals and stuff, she brought fun music that was on the radio that she felt had a message.
Okay.
And she started bringing me in. She said, I heard you had a band. Do you want to sing in choir? No. Well, you can sing any song you want. I said, any song I want. And I came in and did a song by Stevie Wonder, I think. It was called Heaven Help Us All. But from that day, she instilled in me that you can entertain people, but you can also
have a message.
There's a message in there.
How old were you?
This is high school. It took me a while to get on track. You know, I had always been singing and I'd always been playing, but I didn't realize what I wanted to do until then. I signed that first writing deal in Nashville about 4 years ago, so I've learned quite a bit from that town.
Yeah.
Everybody's gifted. Everybody's talented. Oh, my gosh.
What's your group called now?
The band's called Cornbread. Most of it's under Kenny Thomas. You can look up my name, and it's K-E-N-I.
Yes.
Thomas, and it'll show up. If something doesn't show up, somebody's fired.
Well,
we get a chance to go, and we're heading over for the USO tour. This is our sixth time going over, and it's the best show we do all year.
Yeah.
We go Kuwait, Iraq, Afghanistan. We'll go through Christmas.
That's wonderful.
They're so appreciative of someone coming, and it's a gigantic thank you fest. Like, thank you for coming. Oh, thank you for what you're doing over here. And thank you. You know, it's a great
How big is your group?
I take seven.
Are those all performers, or is that part of your setup crew too?
Part of the crew. Now, it's all part of the Sergeant Major of the Army, Sergeant Major Preston. He takes over this tour. It's a USO tour.
Oh, great.
And they bring the Army band, and they have cheerleaders, and they have comedians, and we get to be our act for a while.
Yeah.
The best parts of it are when they helicopter you out to the FOBs, the low forward operating bases, and you kind of just step off the helicopter with a guitar in your hand, and these folks are, there's 50 guys, a platoon-sized element, dusty, dirty, with weapons slung on their back, looking at you going, where's the cheerleaders? So you got to win them over.
You got to climb that mountain.
You got to climb that mountain because I didn't break. I said, I don't have cheerleaders, but I've got Lindy, my violin player. And they all go, yay! You know, so it hadn't changed since Bob Hope. It's still bring an act, bring a comedy, bring a pretty girl, and everybody's happy.
Well, I know you've done a lot of other appearances. Someone told me you'd even had something to do with the Boy Scouts. Have you talked to the
Boy Scouts? Done a lot of appearances. Get to go in and talk to the folks and kind of. Did you know that the Ranger Creed actually has stanzas in it from the Scout motto? So the Sergeant Major who wrote the Creed had to have been an Eagle Scout when he was a younger guy. And I'm very fond of the scouting program because I think that they're teaching the exact thing that's valuable for someone to learn. Lead by example. Set an example for others.
We were talking earlier about be all you can be.
Right.
That's certainly what the Scouts
are
to, and service to others, which I see that you have adopted as your creed as well.
Yes. That's why we were put here.
What else should we know about you?
What else should we know? Well, I'll tell you what was really exciting just happened. I got to sing the anthem at the game one of the series, the World Series up in New York.
Did you sing with your group or by yourself?
No, it was just me. Me and the microphone.
Just stand up there and belt it out?
However many million people were watching. I was very proud of that moment because it was, for a minute and 28 seconds, it was definitely a rock star moment. But you were so proud for, you start thinking about all the people that have supported you and stuck with you. You're thinking of them watching at home, and they're so excited, saying, see, I knew that guy was a good bet. It was kind of a moment of validity. It was great.
Absolutely. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking
with us. I appreciate y'all having me.
On Veterans Chronicles on Radio America.